This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Law and Behold on the Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and of course, it's the last Friday of the month. So we're back with another episode of our ongoing series, wanting to aim all Malaysians with constitutional literacy. And of course, the series is done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. So this month, the news that made the headlines, the Yang di-Pertuan Agong hosted a special conference with other state rulers. And we're going to discuss the outcome of that meeting and also look at the concept of the role of a constitutional monarchy such as ours, and the role of the Conference of Rulers in Malaysia, especially during an emergency. And this month also saw Malaysians going into a stricter lockdown, and with that, a crackdown on undocumented migrants in Malaysia, despite an earlier pledge not to by the authorities. So we're going to look at all these policy reversals that happen and look at what the federal constitution's stipulation is on the right to life and the right to equal treatment, which is guaranteed to all persons. So joining me to do this and more are constitutional lawyer Niu Sin Yu and also Tam Hui Ying, who is the Executive Director of Asylum Access Malaysia. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Hello. Good, good. Not too bad.
Doing well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you, Hui Ying. Also, you know, we're going to find out more about the work you do after this. But first, we want to tackle what actually happened with the Conference of Rulers. So, Sin Yu, we know that the Yang di-Pertuan Agong hosted a special conference, right? As I said, with the state rulers, that was earlier this month. You know, the rulers have said there is no need to extend the state emergency beyond August 1st. And they also called, quote unquote, for the political temperature to be cooled down. So this was also after His Majesty granted audiences to key political leaders. Can you sort of just bring us up to date about, you know, what sort of led up to that meeting with the rulers and what happened after?
Well, basically, we have been in a state of emergency since earlier this year, sometime in January. I think it was 12 January. So Parliament has been suspended. It's closed for the time being. And an emergency ordinance, an emergency was proclaimed and emergency ordinance was promulgated by the government through the Yang di-Pertuan Agong, of course. So there's been a lot of criticisms that has been leveled against the government because in the time of pandemic, you have suspended probably the most important organ of government, that is Parliament. So I think against this backdrop, many months after, of course, we are moving closer to the first August deadline, which was when the emergency was supposed to be or expected to be ending. We have a, well, it wasn't really a meeting of the Conference of Rulers, because a meeting of Conference of Rulers, as required under the federal constitution, you would require the attendance of Menteri Besars. So there wasn't any. So it was a meeting amongst the Yang di-Pertuan Agong and his brethren. Rulers from other states. And basically what they had come out and said is that they are the opinion that the lives and the livelihood of the people, it must be prioritized above all others. They've also gone into the national vaccination program to say that that must be enhanced by reducing the bureaucratic red tape so as to achieve 80% herd immunity as soon as possible. And I think the most important message of all is that Parliament must be reopened as soon as possible.
That's right. And he also said federal parliamentary sessions and state legislative assemblies also need to get going again, right?
Yes, yes. So all organs of the legislature, state and federal, they must sit again.
Okay, so let's talk about what role they play, right? So Malaysia is a constitutional monarchy, and I believe the Agong acts on the advice of the Prime Minister as far as Article 150 is concerned, right? I mean, we know that's how the state of emergency was declared. It was under the YDPA's powers under Article 150 of the Constitution. Can you just remind us about that?
The emergency was declared under Article 150 of the Constitution, which is, it's basically emergency powers that is given to the government during times of emergency where decision-making needs to be really fast, to put it very simply. And it allows the government awesome powers so that they are able to make the difficult decisions in a manner where there are certain checks and balances that would normally be there that is all removed. So how it had worked in the current emergency, it's a bit different from what has happened previously, because this emergency, it was called because it's a health emergency. And the previous emergency, if you would recall, in the 1950s, which lasted for almost 50 years, actually, yeah. That was emergency because there was a communist threat, which somehow only went away in 2011, I think, if I'm not wrong.
I did. It was so bizarre to most of us. You had no clue.
Yeah, exactly. So life went on as normal during that emergency. And Parliament continued to sit. Well, it didn't sit in the first 2 years, but it sat after that. And this emergency was a bit different because Parliament was suspended from the start. So it's closed. So Parliament is obviously an institution where its role, its very role, is not just to make law, but to check on what the executive is doing. So once that is removed, which you can under Article 150, because what Article 150 provides is that the government may promulgate any emergency ordinance, and any emergency ordinance, it's basically a written law which provides the government to do anything. So, for example, if certain part of the Constitution says Parliament needs to sit within a space of 6 months between sittings, and the government passes a law through an emergency ordinance to say that that provision of the Constitution is suspended, even though the Constitution says that you must sit within 6 months, you no longer have to sit within 6 months. And how it works in the context of the Malaysian Constitution is, for Parliament to sit, you would require the YDPA, sorry, the Prime Minister to advise the YDPA to summon Parliament. Mm. So everything, most of the powers of the Yang Diputuan Agong, even though we know, you know, that his Majesty's name keep being thrown in every action that the government do. Actually, it is the Prime Minister that advises the Yang Diputuan Agong to do a certain act. And Parliament cannot sit without Yang Diputuan Agong summoning Parliament, and Yang Diputuan Agong cannot summon Parliament unless the Prime Minister advises the Yang Diputuan Agong. So constitutional safeguards such as Parliament that has been suspended, of course the emergency ordinance that was promulgated in March, actually, it went further than that. It allows the government to withdraw from the consolidated funds without actually passing a supply bill. So that's another example. The fake news ordinance, even though that it's so draconian that you would say that it's a complete prohibition against one's freedom of speech and expression, that too has been allowed under Article 150. The government can prohibit freedom of speech and expression because anything that is inconsistent under the emergency ordinance, even though it goes against what would normally be unconstitutional, that is allowed. So yeah, it really gives the government a blank check to do whatever they want to do. And that's why you're seeing a lot of challenges in court to sort of find out the exact ambit of Article 150.
All right. There's this other article that I came across, which I was hoping you could explain as well. A group of civil societies and think tanks, they call themselves the Seed Community for a Professional Parliament. So they recently came out to say that delaying parliamentary proceedings till after August 1st, which is what the PM has said he might do, right, start in September, puts the YDPA in a difficult position of potentially going against Article 55.1 of the Federal Constitution. What does Article 55.1 actually say? Could you explain what all of this means?
Article 55.1 of the Federal Constitution basically says that, it's like what I said earlier, the Yang Diputuan Agong must not allow there to be more than a 6 months gap between parliamentary sittings.
Okay.
So that has been suspended under the emergency ordinance. So Parliament last sat in December 2020. So they were expected to sit, I think it's June, earlier this month. So in delaying parliamentary proceedings till after August 1, obviously you would have a gap of greater than 6 months. And I think that's what this group of civil societies and think tanks, they are saying. They're saying that Yang Diputuan Agong's role is to prevent 6 months or more gap in parliamentary sittings. So, you know, you are putting His Majesty in a difficult position because you are denying what he is constitutionally required to do. And obviously, you know, the argument is that Article 150 suspends that. So the Constitution itself allows a suspension of Article 55. So His Majesty would not be neglecting His Majesty's constitutional role because it has now been suspended. But this, against the backdrop, against what has been said by the Conference of Rulers, that Parliament must sit as soon as possible, it's certainly unusual, but I think it's basically the rulers coming out to say that, look, we don't think that it's right for Parliament to be suspended, and certain parts of the Constitution is so important, it's wrong to just suspend it, especially when the reason for suspension is something as tenuous as public health emergency, which I personally feel that, you know, that excuse, it is invalid. It's not a good excuse to suspend Parliament, and there's certain measures to contain or control the safety of parliamentarians and state assembly persons. So this difficulty, I think we're also seeing in the development that in what's been happening in the various state legislative assemblies in recent days, where the chief ministers, they are coming out to say that the state legislative assemblies, they can now sit after August 1. And I think in the context of Johor, if I'm not wrong, the Johor ruler has decreed that the Johor State Assembly can now convene, I think August 12th, if I'm not wrong. So we're seeing a constitutional crisis, and I kid you not, and I don't use that word lightly. We're seeing a constitutional crisis because emergency might be extended, and if emergency is extended, there will be a clash between what's happening at the state level and what's happening at federal level. So there is a likelihood that the decree by the Sultan of Johor to summon the State Legislative Assembly to convene on the 12th of August, that might have to be cancelled. And you know, it creates a very awkward situation for the Johor ruler. And it also pits the Prime Minister against what has been said by the Conference of Rulers and the Yang Diputuan Agong.
Okay, I guess we don't exactly know. The Prime Minister hasn't given an official sort of statement, I suppose. He said September, right? But we're not sure what his official stand is. Am I correct in saying that? We don't exactly know the final decision, whether he's going to reconvene Parliament in August or in September. I guess we have to just wait and see what happens and whether there is going to be a constitutional crisis on our hands.
Yeah, the thing is that this declaration of this emergency and summoning Parliament, it's intertwined, even though it shouldn't be. Because we are seeing the provision in the Emergency Ordinance, I think Section 14, which suspends Parliament. But we have a situation, and it might get a bit convoluted and confusing here. We have a situation where if emergency is extended, the emergency ordinance would be extended and suspension of Parliament would then be extended, unless Prime Minister comes out and say that it's okay for Parliament to sit, and I'm advising the Yang Diputuan Agong to summon Parliament. So you can summon the Parliament without lifting the emergency, but once you lift the emergency, Parliament must immediately sit, because remember what I said about Article 55 earlier, that you can't have a gap of more than 6 months.
Yeah.
The moment you lift the emergency, and that would mean that there is already, there is already more than 6 months gap. So Parliament must sit immediately the next day after emergency is lifted. So it really depends what the Prime Minister chooses to do. If the Prime Minister chooses to lift emergency, Parliament must then sit. But the Prime Minister may say that I'm extending emergency, and I will decide for whether Parliament and the state legislative assemblies can sit later. So that's the situation.
All right. So ultimately, it is the Prime Minister who has to make that final decision then, right? It's not. We know that the YDP has to act on the advice of the Prime Minister. So it's basically the Prime Minister who has the final say in that sense.
Yes, because it's a constitutional monarchy. So even though the YDPA is the one summoning Parliament, but he can't exercise his powers because there is no advice that is coming. And that's the wording of Article 40, which is not... but it's not suspended, it's still in operation. I know there has been some views that the YDPA can summon Parliament on his own accord. I don't agree with those views, because what we must remember is that one of the core principles, one of the basic structure of the federal constitution is that we are a constitutional monarchy, we are not an absolute monarchy. So the Yang Lipton Agong, His Majesty cannot summon Parliament on his own accord, even though Section 14, 1B of the Emergency Ordinance states that Parliament shall be summoned as the Yang Lipton Agong thinks appropriate. This power must be read with Article 40 of the Federal Constitution. And Article 40 of the Federal Constitution basically states that the Yang Lipton Agong must act on advice of the Cabinet Prime Minister. In the exercise of his function under federal law. So therefore, the Yang Lipton Agong cannot summon Parliament unless advised by the Prime Minister to do so. And this phrase, the Yang Lipton Agong thinks appropriate, it's a phrase that is commonly found in other written laws. It's a common phrase, really. And have always been understood to mean that the Yang Lipton Agong acts on advice. So some quarters, they are blatantly misconstruing established legal principles to suit the desired outcome. And I don't think that's right, because it will be precedent. They are saying that Section 18 of the ordinance, which is an overriding clause, it applies to allow Section 14 to prevail over Article 40. But I don't think that is the case, because there is no inconsistency. The phrase Yang Lipton Agong thinks appropriate, like I say, it's understood to mean that His Majesty acts on advice. The problem is that people are reading it literally. You know, that would mean that we are dragging the Yang Lipton Agong into our own mess. So speak to MPs, your aduns, your local politicians, and tell them to end the emergency and lobby for Parliament to reconvene. Don't lobby the Yang Lipton Agong. And if they don't, speak to everyone you know to, you know, kick your MPs, aduns, and local politicians out.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break. I'm speaking today to constitutional lawyer Niu Sin Yu, and also joining us, who hasn't spoken yet, but we will get to you soon, is Tham Hui Ying. She's the executive director of Asylum Access Malaysia. Earlier, we were talking about constitutional monarchies and, you know, the role they play in Malaysia. But after this quick break, we're going to find out about how undocumented migrants are being treated, you know, during this pandemic. And we're going to look at what needs to be done to help protect them more. That's coming up after this quick break. You're listening to Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line are Niu Sin Yu. He's a constitutional lawyer. And also joining us is Tham Hui Ying. She's the executive director of Asylum Access Malaysia. We're looking back at, you know, some of the headlines from June 2021 and, you know, how that's related to the constitution. Earlier before the break, we were talking about the role of, you know, constitutional monarchies, what that means, you know, what that means, especially in the context of the emergency. But now we want to go into, you know, other huge headlines that we saw saw throughout the month of June, and that is, you know, how there was a crackdown on undocumented migrants in Malaysia as we went into a stricter lockdown. And, you know, we saw some horrible things. We're going to find out what. But Huiying, before we get into all of that, you are, as I mentioned, the Executive Director of Asylum Access Malaysia. So you obviously have been working with a lot of these undocumented migrants, right? Tell me a little bit about the work that you do first.
Yeah, so Asylum Access Malaysia is a locally registered NGO pushing for a Malaysia in which all refugees can feel safe and rebuild their lives. We adopt a human rights approach to refugee response, and we're primarily focused on creating a systemic change through legal empowerment and policy advocacy. So I think the ultimate goal for us is to have a framework that is responsive to, you know, refugee voices.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So I think you've been pretty busy, I'm guessing, this month, you know, with everything that's been happening. Can you bring us up to speed? You know, I mean, like I mentioned, you know, we went into a strict second lockdown at the start of the month. But at the same time, you know, the Minister of Home Affairs said that those without valid documents, they're going to be rounded up. They're not going to be vaccinated. You know, so many things, reversals of policies. Can you bring us up to speed about what's been happening?
Sure. I'll try to summarize it as best as I can. Sure. Maybe sort of just to start. I mean, we work primarily with refugees and asylum seekers. And, you know, part of the reason why they're sort of in this subset of undocumented migrants is because Malaysia doesn't have a framework, right, that specifically sort of recognizes them and provide them with sort of protection. And so any time the government says anything, you know, about undocumented migrants, we are sort of put on edge because, you know, we know that refugees and asylum seekers are going to be impacted despite the fact that they do have sort of like, you know, international protection, right? So I think it's kind of hard to pinpoint a sort of start, right? Because I think that this has been going on since, I think, our lockdown back in March 2020. But if we were to sort of look at like sort of this year, right, and in particular, the sort of vaccination, this whole question around vaccination and whether or not refugees, asylum seekers, other undocumented persons are going to be vaccinated, we can sort of trace it back to sort of February, maybe, when sort of Khairi announced that, you know, everyone, regardless of their document status, will be vaccinated. And he specifically mentioned refugees, and he used the term undocumented persons, which sort of all of us were like, yes, you know, finally people are using the right terminology as opposed to like, you know, a quote unquote illegal immigrants. And I think that, like, you know, so we sort of like really look forward to it. So at the time, it was just an announcement, and it was just waiting for an official policy, because we know what announcements are like, right? Like announcements only mean this much. And at the end of the day, it's about implementation and sort of what the rollout is going to be like. And it wasn't sort of forthcoming. And then by, like, I think March again, you know, there were reassurances by Khairi that there is going to be a strategy. But at the same time, and I don't know if this is sort of like noticed, but in certain sort of social media, for example, there were comments about how, oh, we may not need to vaccinate everyone if we're going to like achieve sort of herd immunity before that. So it's sort of start seeing sort of like contradictory comments about this. And then by like sort of June, I think when we had the stricter lockdown, it was sort of very clear that that policy wasn't going to happen, right? Because the Ministry of Home Affairs had like sort of openly announced that, you know, with this lockdown, there's going to be an increase in crackdowns of undocumented migrants, which of course would sort of put them in fear and, you know, would make it very difficult for them to sort of come forward for vaccination, especially since, you know, there hasn't been any reassurances, you know, that they would be vaccinated and that there wouldn't be any sort of action taken against their status, right? And now when you have the Ministry of Home Affairs sort of coming forward and saying, yes, we will arrest and detain all those with no documents, you know, it creates a really unsafe environment. But I would say that, like, you know, because of the sort of comments that popped up after the announcements in February and March, it is a little bit sort of by design. I think if you notice in the different iterations of our lockdown, right, there's always some sort of comment around, oh, our borders, border protection. So it'll be like, I mean, I don't know which sort of different MCOs we've had, but sort of, you know, we have, you know, a sort of slight variation, and it will be like at the end of the statement, it'll be, oh, yeah, but we're also, you know, cracking down on like, you know, illegal like immigrants. We are, you know, protecting our borders. And so in some ways, it's sort of like building up to the sort of like lockdown. And once you have the lockdown, it's like, okay, you know, now that we have lockdown, this is going to be our policy. We're going to be arresting and detaining undocumented migrants. Yeah, so I think that it's just like a very worrying sort of situation. It's like on the one hand, you've got this minister encouraging people to vaccinate. And, you know, from a public health perspective, it's very problematic because, like, you know, how are you going to get people to come forward and be vaccinated if there isn't a guarantee that, you know, you aren't going to be arrested, detained and put in an immigration detention center almost indefinitely, right? And so I think that that's kind of like a huge cause for concern.
Yeah, because again, this policy sort of flip-flop. I mean, okay, there was no policy, I suppose, in writing, right? But I mean, this is what was said by the ministers, contradicting each other. And this kind of harks back to what happened last year as well, right? When they said that, okay, this is when they wanted them to come forward for testing. They said that nothing would happen to them, you know, if you come forward for testing. But then at the same time, again, they were rounded up and they were, you know, treated very inhumanely. Am I correct? Is that what also happened last year?
Yeah. And that's why I sort of mentioned that the timeline sort of starts like way advanced. We're seeing the same thing sort of happening again. And I think what was particularly insidious about the way that they did it last year was that there were certain places that were put under enhanced MCO, if you remember, which meant that they couldn't leave the vicinity of their sort of building. And what would happen is they would go in, take all of their details, like for screening purposes, allegedly. And then once the 2-week period was over and the lockdown was lifted, they went in and they raided and arrested people. So it's like, it's a huge breach of trust, right? You know, and we're starting from that. We're starting from that massive deficit of trust that's, you know, sort of been building since last year. And now we're coming here and, like, again, you know, just when you've sort of like made some sort of headway by, you know, making this sort of very clear announcement about vaccinations, you're now then sort of taking a massive step back by your, like, sort of announcements and your policies. And I think what's scarier this time is that there is this sort of like almost like a state-funded campaign that's going along with this raids and arrests, right? Like, you know, on social media, there's been this sort of a lot of things that's been sort of, I think, circulating posters created by the National Task Force, right? National meaning we know for sure that this is something that's sort of state-funded. And this is just this question of like, you know, but in the middle of a pandemic, right? You know, people are suffering and we're having sort of all these, like, people are like concerned, right, about their livelihoods. And like, state funds are being utilized for this sort of campaign. And like, you've got to wonder, like, just what's behind that, right? Yeah. And I think that, like, that sort of like campaign going along with that just adds to that sort of atmosphere, right? And I think that even with the sort, like, okay, one is the sort of state persecution, right? But the other thing is how that sort of translates to, you know, more xenophobia and discrimination on the ground, which then, you know, sort of really adds into this environment of fear. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what I think you're talking about also is how the Immigration Department, they had a post on their Facebook page. It was styled like a poster for an action movie. It had the headline, "Ethnic Rohingya migrants are not welcome." I mean, gosh, to do that publicly. And it was only deleted after an outcry, I think, you know. But I mean, obviously the refugee community saw that, isn't it? Like you said, would have just added to the culture of fear and distrust.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And okay, so we know that the minister, Home Minister Hamza Zainuddin, he declared that, you know, all you know, undocumented migrants would be detained, sent to immigration detention centres. He stressed that they had to surrender before they would be vaccinated. Then another statement he said is, we are rounding them up to make sure that they are vaccinated. You know, so many different reasons for this happening. And they were treated very inhumanely, am I correct, when they were rounded up, some of these undocumented migrants? Can you remind us about what happened during some of these raids?
Yeah, so I think that, like, this time around, if you've noticed, like, with the raids, you actually have a lot more images. So if I'm not mistaken, like, press were, like, sort of maybe even invited on these raids, right? And you've seen these kind of images. Even in some pictures, I think children, women were there, sort of, like, herded in some ways, right? Like, herded, no social distancing, handcuffed in the middle of a, you know, a pandemic, right? Like, we're talking about thousands of cases, you know, no distancing, like, you know, officers, like a few officers, like pressing down on one person, you know, it's, and the sort of like language and imagery that's used, right? Hunting down, you know, like really just sort of dehumanizing, you know, and also sort of like, and I think one thing that sort of maybe sparked some sort of outrage was the sort of spraying of Dettol on people. And very quickly, sort of like people from the medical profession came forward and said that there's absolutely no basis to do that. You know, it's like, it's the kind of extent that we sort of treat that, like, you know, we can treat another sort of human being in that kind of way. It's just absolutely astounding, horrifying, horrifying, absolutely, but also kind of astounding that, you know, we can get to that kind of point, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we happily bring them in to do the works that we don't want to do. We don't prosecute the ones that bring them in illegally. We prosecute them and persecute them, actually. Let's talk about the rights that non-Malaysians have, right? You know, if they've been arrested or they've been detained under the Immigration Act, what sort of legal rights are afforded to them? Maybe Sinyu, you can help out. Yeah.
So Article 5 of the Federal Constitution, it sets out a person's right to life. So what's important here is that the wording of Article 5, it refers to person. And there are some parts of the Federal Constitution, when it comes to fundamental liberties, it refers to non-citizens or citizens, rather. You wouldn't have non-citizens. So it's important that Article 5.1, it refers to no person. And the full wording of Article 5.1 is that no person shall be deprived of his life or personal liberty, save in accordance with law. And this is important because this article would apply to non-citizens. Article 10, for example, it applies to only citizens. Every citizen shall have the freedom of speech and expression, for example. So you know that those who are not citizens, they wouldn't be protected under Article 10. But the problem with, even though Article 5.1, it says that no person shall be deprived of his life or personal liberty safe in accordance with law, it goes on to say that a person who is not a citizen, they have to be brought before a magistrate without unreasonable delay within 14 days. So that's a 2 weeks period. It's a very long period of time. If we compare it to the right of a citizen that is to be brought before a magistrate when they are arrested, within 24 hours. So immediately you would see that there is a discrimination that is built within the wordings of Article 5 itself. So when we go down to the ground in practice, we would be doing remand cases. You know, I'm not sure if you have had the experience of doing remand cases in Jinjiang Detention Center and Damwangi Detention Center. You would see that immigrants, non-citizens, they are being brought in, you know, in a very big group. And it's normally brought in a group of 10, 20, 30, sometimes even more. And they would just be produced before a magistrate. And the magistrate would just grant them remand orders for 14 days, for example. So if you're not a citizen, there's a 14 days gap before you're brought before a magistrate. And from our experience on the ground, we know that, you know, you don't need 14 days to investigate whether or not this person is validly here within Malaysia. So it could be a very simple case of the person forgetting to bring along his passport when he goes down to the street to buy nasi lemak, for example. And he gets stopped and the police ask him, where's your documentation? He couldn't produce it. Okay, arrest. And as a result of that, 14 days later, he's only brought before a magistrate, even though, you know, there's a very quick solution there. But what is important here is that the law as it stands, and this is something that we need to change, it allows discrimination against non-citizens, and it allows very wide and potentially arbitrary powers that are afforded to the authorities, which we know that, you know, it's wrong, morally wrong. And that's something that we should look, even though we keep saying that federal constitution is the supreme law of the land, federal constitution is the supreme law of the land, you know, we fail to recognize that it has its flaws. And when we say that we are going to defend what is said in the constitution, yes, for the good parts, but for the bad parts, we shouldn't stop. We should criticize it because it is wrong and it is questionable. I'll just stop there for now.
Ahuing, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, sort of, when it comes to immigration offences, at least from our sort of experience, it's even trickier because, you know, sometimes what they do is the courts are actually within sort of the detention centres or in those kind of vicinities. And so they're oftentimes sort of far from the city. People don't even know when sometimes people are brought before immigration court. And you know, in general, sort of under the Immigration Act, there is no right to legal representation. And so the entire process is extremely opaque. And so when someone's sort of arrested by an immigration officer, for example, and is placed in an immigration detention center, there just simply is no way of tracing or finding out where they are. And that's sort of the biggest challenge that we have. And also, maybe just to sort of flag that, like, this sort of additional sort of injustice that, like, undocumented migrants, refugees and asylum seekers face is, take, for example, you know, MCO offences, right? So last year, we saw sort of, like, an increase in people sort of being arrested for MCO offences. So in addition to the MCO offences, you know, they were also tagged on with an immigration offence. And so after they had either served their time or paid the fine under the MCO offence, they were nevertheless transferred into the custody of immigration detention. And immigration authorities and, like, we just have not been able to sort of secure their release. So that's something that's really concerning. Just to also flag, you know, on the point that you made about, you know, people sort of, like, not really needing 14 days to verify someone's status. So, you know, even people with UNHCR documentation, right? You know, it's like, it's very, very fast. You don't need 14 days to verify their UNHCR status. But yet, you know, that's what's happened. And, you know, most of the time, the practice is to just hold people for those 14 days because, you know, it's provided for without really sort of examining the need for it. And also, 14 days is a very long time. You know, a lot of things can happen within 14 days. People can transfer from police custody to immigration custody at the blink of an eye. And, you know, we know that UNHCR has not had access since August 2019. And so we can only guess how many asylum seekers and refugees may be in detention because of this, you know.
And when they are put in these detention centres, right, we've heard reports of them being mistreated or abused or, you know, those sorts of things. Is there any mechanisms that can actually challenge these sorts of detention conditions? Is there anything that can be done to protect them in that sense?
Well, it's really a very heavy question to dissect. I think let's start out with the obvious. The laws governing these detention centres, they themselves are quite problematic. And even what is written in the law, like, for example, detention centres, you know, it would state how big certain cells are. Even that doesn't measure up to international standards. And when the authorities say they're only following the law, that itself is a problematic proposition to make, because the law is a bad law. But to answer your question, what judicial remedies are afforded to them? Article 8.1, and this to me is one of my favorite provisions in the Constitution, because Article 8 deals with equality. And Article 8.1, it deals with equal protection of the law. What it has in effect is that it protects against arbitrary use of power by the executive. Mm-hmm. And it applies to all persons, like I've mentioned earlier. Article 8.2, however, only protects citizens, and it prohibits discrimination on certain grounds, gender, descent, religion, etc. So Article 8.1, it's important Article 8.1 is still functional, and it allows those who are not citizens to invoke it. And how do they invoke it? Like, for example, if their detention is unlawful, in the sense that, I think we recently saw that a Nigerian student who was here in Malaysia, this is a student, could be a student, but he had a visa, but he was detained by immigration. So the court granted a habeas corpus for his release. So habeas corpus, it's an application to court, and it's actually a constitutionally provided way for someone to challenge the lawfulness of their detention. He applied the habeas corpus, and the court agreed that, yeah, he was illegally, unlawfully detained. So that's available to non-citizens. Of course, the problem, again, is lawfulness of the detention. Malaysian law doesn't recognize refugees. It doesn't recognize asylum seekers. It has a blanket provision under the Immigration Act, where if you enter the country without valid documentation. Even if your reason may be to escape imminent harm or threat to your life, as an someone who comes here to seek asylum would, you are automatically a criminal. You'll be committing an offense. So habeas corpus, even though it's available to them, but they are, I don't want to use the word criminal, but under the laws, they are a criminal, even though it's a wrong thing to use, but Malaysian law is such, you cannot use habeas corpus to challenge the fact that you are not in breach of the Immigration Act, because you are, even though you might be an asylum seeker. So luckily, there is an understanding between the government and we know that there is an understanding in between the Attorney General Chambers with UNHCR that any asylum seekers, as long as they hold a UNHCR card, they're recognized by UNHCR as being a refugee, there will not be any prosecution against asylum seekers. So it's difficult.
Sarah Hui, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, so I think just sort of going back to what I mentioned about, like, you know, detention centers being almost like a black hole. And so kind of like, you know, how do you sort of talk about your experiences? You know, how do you get redress for any sort of like mistreatment within the detention centers? I think that's the hard part, right? So, you know, as I've mentioned, it's just once people get into detention centers, there's just no way to find out where they are, like locate where they are or how they're doing, and to find ways to sort of secure their release. And I mean, the worst case is that, like, you know, if they do somehow manage to sort of, you know, seek assistance from within the detention centers, you know, there's fear of retaliation, right? Like, you are in this space, you know, confined, you don't have access to anyone outside. And, you know, we've also sort of read about deaths in immigration detention centers, right? And that's the sort of like worst outcome possible. Yeah, so like I think that that's a very real question about, you know, what kind of oversight is available and, you know, what sort of redress do detainees have, you know? And I think it's a question for us to really sort of like think about and assess, because it's really concerning. I mean, we know about, we've read so many reports, right, of the conditions in detention. We know that it's overcrowded, you know, unsanitary. People who did not have COVID contracted COVID, you know, after being put into detention centres, and that says a lot about, you know, the conditions in detention. We know all these things, and yet, you know, there's so little in terms of what we can do, you know, to address the situation and to seek redress.
Yeah, and I mean, as we said, you know, everything is being done currently to prevent the pandemic from getting any worse. But, you know, these sorts of policies, actually, I mean, we have to acknowledge that undocumented migrants are living among us. And if we don't protect them, we are not protecting ourselves as well, right? If you want to look at it in that selfish sort of way, right? I mean, we have to do what's best for everyone. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but, you know, if there's any sort of last message that you'd like to leave us with, maybe with regard to, you know, what sort of inclusive, non-discriminatory policies that we need to strengthen our response to the pandemic, what would your final message be?
I think it's time that we really need to reflect on our actions collectively as a society, because even though, you know, we can always say that the government is to blame, the government is taking all these measures to discriminate and wrongfully treat undocumented migrants, society and some of the reactions that you could see on social media, it emboldens them, and in a way it validates them, wrongly, of course. So I think we really need to do a self-reflection as a nation. You know, when we talk about rights and liberties, but we only have such outrage, or we only talk about rights and liberties in the context of citizens, in the context of the bangsa elites, the champagne activists. But when it comes to those who we do not see, like those who are in the detention centres, they're hidden there. You know, a lot of people don't know how it is like there. In Semenye, for example, that's something that we should probably broaden our horizons to talk about them as well. So don't forget them in our conversations when we talk about rights and liberties. That's my message.
Thanks, Sinyo. What about you, Huiying?
I have a bit of a longer message. But I think following from what Sinyu was saying, you know, really sort of like the reflection, I think, as a nation is very much needed. And I think really sort of understanding that our rights are all sort of interconnected. And it's going to be very difficult to recover as a nation when there are so many people, you know, facing violence and discrimination, you know, in our country. And I think like we all need to be reminded, you know, that the common enemy here is the pandemic, right? The common enemy is in some instances, incompetence. And, you know, we need to be holding our governments accountable and to a much higher standard in terms of human rights. You know, it isn't about pitting one group against the other that, like, you know, giving rights to refugees doesn't mean less rights for Malaysians, but, you know, it means just rights for all, you know, really changing that sort of perspective. I also wanted to offer sort of in terms of some very tangible, maybe, policy sort of suggestions, right? So I think firstly, like, we really need to stop the raids and arrests. Like, that is really not going to help us with the sort of, you know, recovery, right? You know, other countries are actually thinking about active ways, I think since the start of the pandemic, to really getting people, into sort of detention centers, right? So really needing to have a very clear non-detention, you know, policy directive. So, you know, take US, for example, right? One of the first things Biden said, you know, he came up very clearly and unequivocally stated that, yes, you know, all undocumented persons are going to get vaccines and we are not going to, you know, arrest you because of your immigration status, right? It's very important to rebuild trust. And, you know, we really need to sort of work on it like a lot sooner. And I think that, you know, we're already starting from such a massive trust deficit that we really need to actively sort of work with UNHCR, NGOs on the ground to sort of rebuild that sort of trust with the community. And also to sort of, you know, improve understanding and curb misinformation around vaccines. So that's all sort of work that needs to be done. I think, again, sort of in terms of short term, you know, really needing to grant UNHCR access to IDCs. You know, we're coming up to almost 2 years, of, you know, asylum seekers, refugees not being able to seek asylum, right, which is a very fundamental right that's afforded under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I think long term, we really need to think about, you know, healthcare reform. We really need to center healthcare as a right. We really need to think about sort of, you know, the, you know, massive barriers that refugees, asylum seekers, undocumented persons face when trying to access healthcare. You know, the cost of healthcare is exorbitant. And we have, and I think more importantly, you know, in 2001, there was a Ministry of Health has a circular 10, which mandates healthcare providers, government healthcare providers to report undocumented persons to immigration authorities. So that really has to go. You know, we really need to have a firewall between health services and immigration. You know, the fear of arrest cannot be the thing that's stopping people from accessing life-saving treatment, you know, or a basic right like healthcare. And I think just sort of overall saying that, like, you know, ultimately what we need is to have, you know, some sort of framework, a rights-respecting framework for refugees and asylum seekers, you know, and we really need to think about, yeah, like, you know, how are we sort of ensuring that there's protection afforded for the different categories of people. And I think also thinking about addressing the root causes of how people become undocumented in Malaysia, right? Because I think that it's very easy to say, well, they committed, but the question is why? And I think it's a very complex issue, and it's not one that I'm sort of well-versed in, but wanted to offer that thought that, like, so from refugees, asylum seekers' perspective, there needing to be a sort of really comprehensive framework for other undocumented persons to really think about addressing the sort of root causes of why they become undocumented and really examine those questions. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to constitutional lawyer Niu Sin Yu and Tam Hui Ying, who is the executive director of Asylum Access Malaysia. If you'd like to find out more about the work that Hui Ying is doing, you can just head to asylumaccess.org. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Law and Behold interviews, just search for the podcast at bfm.my/learn or on the BFM app. This has been Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.